faith isn't blind anything. It's you don't have to turn, you know, you don't have to turn your brain off in church, and you don't have to turn your faith off in the library. Like they're all part of you. You have to be an integral whole and move from place to place. And I think God's not going to get mad if we ask questions.
No,
you know, like he wants that honest relationship, and he wants someone who is seeking him.
Cassandra Nelson is a visiting fellow in literature at the Lumen Center, a community of scholars seeking to deepen the dialogue between Christian thought and academic disciplines. She's also an associate fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture, and has taught previously at the U.S. Military Academy. Cassandra writes about faith, fiction, technology, and culture, and she recently published the book we'll discuss today, A Theology of Fiction, published through Wise Blood Books. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Okay, so 3 years ago, I read a short and to me compelling book by Joshua Wren. It was titled Contemplative Realism, A Theological Aesthetical Manifesto. And I subsequently had Joshua on as a podcast guest, and it was then that I learned about Wise Blood Books, which published that book. And this is a small but really smart press producing beautiful books, most of which are written in light of the Catholic tradition. And since then, I've read several titles published by that press. I was excited to see the recent publication of a book titled A Theology of Fiction, published by today's guest, Cassandra Nelson. Welcome, Cassandra, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Matt, for having me here.
It's a delight. So this book, A Theology of Fiction, is a short book. And if I'm right on this, you originally conceived of it as an article, right? Published in the magazine First Things, is that right? And if that's true, what was the genesis of that article, and what got it from the article form to its current form as a book?
I guess it's a three-part thing. So the first part was all the way back in 2005 or 2006. I was looking for a project to do a master's degree at the Editorial Institute at Boston University. And the thing I was doing before we started this call was finishing up an essay for a Festschrift for my advisor, Christopher Ricks. And so it's all fresh in my mind because I've just been down memory lane. But the way I remember it is Christopher, he's so brilliant, and he has so many good ideas that he can just give them away for free. So he, you know, he knew I was starting out. I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I literally remember him sort of rummaging in a desk drawer. And then he said, how about J.F. Powers? Why don't you read some stories by J.F. Powers? And no one needed a new edition for that because it had just been, all his books had been brought back into print by New York Review Books Classics. But in reading around the subject, I found out that his wife had been a writer. There's one paragraph in a biography. So I looked her stuff up in the microfilm room of the library. The New Yorker archives were not online yet then. And then when I got a hold of Betty Wall, that was his wife, of her manuscripts, hidden in those papers, I found references to and words by Sister Mariella Gable. So that was my unusual introduction to Sister Mariella. And then I didn't think about it for however many years. And fast forward to the conversation that's been ongoing in the pages, not strictly, but a lot in the pages of First Things magazine about sort of where has Catholic fiction gone. Dana Gioia, who is also a big Joshua Wren fan and supporter, asking, where did the Flannery O'Connors go? Where did the Walker Percys go? Did the culture change? Did we change? What's happened? Can we make up for this? You know, can we recover this lost ground? And I realized, I guess in 2021, hey, like I know someone who has some smart things to say about Catholic fiction. And it was sort of, at that point, it wasn't locked up in the archives. And a nun at the College of St. Benedict, Sister Nancy Hines, who has since died, she was working on the papers of Sister Mariella when I was working on Betty Wall. And she got her edition out. So at least you can read them now, her essays. And so, yeah, in 2021, I said, you know, I know a smart lady who needs a seat at this table. And I decided to write this essay and pull up a chair for Sister Mariella. And then actually, Joshua Wren and I were introduced by email around that time, maybe a little bit after. And he said, oh, you should make it a book for Wise Blood. And I tried to just take the path of least resistance. And I thought, why don't I just keep it as it is and add a couple of chapter breaks and then take the money and run. And it took me a while to loop around, find a trusted friend who would look at a bad draft, help me figure out which parts were bad. And so, yeah, so it took two tries to get the final book, but in the end, God didn't let me cut the corners. I had to, it was 5,000 words and now it's 20,000, so I had to actually do quite a lot more research and writing and reorganization.
It's a very thoughtful book, and it's a very fine 20,000 words. I really enjoyed this book a lot, a great deal. Let me ask you about, so I asked you about how the
Thank
book
you.
got to where it is. I'm curious about what got you to where you are, right? So like me, you earned a PhD in English. You got yours from Harvard. I got mine from UCLA. And have you always written about religious subjects, right? Or at what point did you begin writing on those subjects, and not only for other scholars, but also for a wider reading public, like in venues like First Things, for example?
That is such a good question. And I'm like, what's your story? Like, what? Now I want to know everyone's story
Right.
who's looped into the Christian Poetics Initiative or in this field. I think, again, because Christopher Ricks is on my brain today, there was a moment when I was wrapping up my PhD and I was trying to find a job. And that's really depressing, as you are probably aware. The odds are not great. And there was a very strict five paragraph formula that I was told to follow in, 2013, 2014. I don't remember what it was now, but it was very elaborate and you weren't allowed to deviate. And 700 people applied for every job. And I remember Christopher saying, well, if 500 people are applying for every job and they're all following the same formula, why don't you try a different kind of letter? Could that hurt too? And so I tried to write a couple of cover letters like a human being rather than following the elaborate kabuki dance that the graduate placement officer told us that we must do or something. And so I think I kind of took that advice with my scholarship as well. If everyone's trying to do this and we're fighting for way too few spots, maybe do something different. And magazine publishing for me is it's been sort of luck or providence, or you weren't sure how you found contemplative realism. I'm not sure how I got looped in, but when the opportunity was there, it was appealing to write for magazines that you hope someone might actually read. And then every once in a while I get an email and I find out someone did read it.
Yeah, no, there's a talent for doing it. I know a lot of scholars who are really, really very, very fine at writing for other scholars. They write in academic journals, they write, academic books that go into university libraries, and they're very, very good at it. But you get a lot of these folks trying to write for a general public, they cannot. It's like they trip over themselves. They cannot find a way to write a clear sentence. And this is something that you do very well. It's a very distinctive skill. I've talked with scholars here at BYU before. Some of them who are very good at this talk about how hard it was to learn to write for people other than just their own peers. And so kudos to you for the ability to do that.
Well, I forgot. Yeah, my first for 4 years between my undergrad and PhD, I worked in university administration and communications, and so I think I learned how to write memos and appeal letters and annual reports and things like that. But here's a free piece of advice, and it's not even from me. It's from Pulitzer Prize-winning New Yorker writer Louis Menand. In grad school, there was like a little seminar on writing for the public, and the thing that I remember Luc Menand saying that day was, "When you're writing for academic audiences, the goal is to sound smart. Where you're like, look at me, I know so much. I'm in the guild. Here's the proof." And then when you're writing for the general public, the goal is to make your reader feel smart. And so he was like, all you have to do is add a clause, William James, American, philosopher or whatever, and then you keep going. Like that's it. And I think what my time in communications at the start of my work life, and what Luc Menand were saying was just it's like audience, like what do they know? What do they not know? How do I start the story? What context do they need to for this sentence to make sense?
Yeah, good. I think that I've read him actually. I don't know him, unlike you, but I've read him, like Louis Menand.
I barely know him, and he was my dissertation advisor. He's kind of a mystery.
Yes, yeah. Sphinx of a man.
Once he said "great" on a chapter, and that was like the only feedback, and I was like, "That's a ticker tape parade." From, but I think he's really friendly with like the undergrads. Yeah. Like I would teach undergrads and they would be like, oh, I was in Luke's office for 2 hours. And I was like, I was never in there for more than 2 minutes. But anyway.
I've heard him talk about this kind of thing though, right? And there is a different kind of a way, a different kind of voice you have to kind of craft and a different way of writing. Let me ask you something about this though, because you're talking about good advice given to you by your dissertation advisor at Harvard that allowed you to write for venues like First Things, for example, right? Near the end of your book, you write about, and this is, I'm quoting here, you're looking for authors who had depth, wisdom, vision, and truth. And you write about feeling some frustration that you weren't always able to communicate that desire to your teachers, including in the PhD program you're in. It's become, I think, popular in some religious circles for groups to rail against education, secular education, right? And I'm wondering whether and how you've managed to meld both your education with writing, you know, on religious subjects. I'm wondering whether your education in a secular PhD program made it possible for you to write in some ways as a religious writer in ways you might not be able to do so if you'd not received that secular education.
Yeah, it's very strange because I am completely the product of American public schools and, secular higher education. I mean, like, Boston University has Methodist roots, but nobody talked about, you know, Methodism when I was there. And yet all the while my faith grew. And Romano Guardini has a quote in The Life of Faith, I think is the name of the book, where like you can't inherit your parents' faith. Even if you had the perfect family, which I didn't, and maybe nobody ever does in real life, it wouldn't be enough. It has to be reconstituted in you, what you've inherited. And so the moments in my educational experience where there was some pushback or questioning, they were so good for teaching me that faith isn't blind anything. It's you don't have to turn, you know, you don't have to turn your brain off in church, and you don't have to turn your faith off in the library. Like they're all part of you. You have to be an integral whole and move from place to place. And I think God's not going to get mad if we ask questions.
No,
you know, like he wants that honest relationship, and he wants someone who is seeking him. But so I think what the sort of secular education did was like craft. It taught me the standards of my field and writing and reading, you know, as a literary critic or just reading as a person with their eyes open. Like kids also are really good close readers. Like little kids are terrifyingly good close readers. So the skill set that was developed there also worked in moving through the world and also worked in, you know, reading the Bible or whatever, though I wasn't conscious of that process. But I think it was maybe excellence in the sense that Aristotle would use the word.
Yeah, okay, good. And I really appreciate, by the way, that you talk about how you don't just kind of cut your faith off in the rest of your life. I mean, you know, this institute that houses these podcasts and promotes this podcast is titled the Faith and Imagination Institute. And these two things I find are profoundly linked. And imagination, you're not meaning invented. Imagine being that the capacity of mind to be able to conceive of things broadly and largely and deeply. And faith is a part of that, you know, kind of imaginative process, that conceptual, kind of full-bodied engagement of the world, really, which I love, and I appreciate you saying that so much.
And I love the imagination is not invention. Like, it's not fantasy.
Right.
It's the image generator in our brain and what it's capable of picturing and how much, you know, how much or how little. Like, can you zoom in like a microscope and see something closely? Can you zoom out and try to take in the whole of the cosmos? You know, I can't do that very well, but I can sort of try for a second, you know? And I think that image generator in the mind is a real gift. and something that we have the capacity to either develop or let atrophy. And I'm really, really freaked out by how many ready-made images people are taking in with their eyeballs these days, and how little time is spent with the work of, reading like black and white marks on a page, like 26 letters in the alphabet, but they can be rearranged to make entire worlds.
Yeah, good. Right.
So don't, yeah, so like we need to talk more about the imagination and the fact that, why believers might want to think about that and devote
Amen.
resources to developing that.
Amen to that. So how do you this back to your book here, this book, A Theology of Fiction, how do you understand the book's title phrase, A Theology of Fiction? And I ask this, here's why I ask this for our listeners. It's not really a book about elaborate theological concepts, and there's not a chapter on Christology or pneumatology or sort of relationship between works and grace and so on. Instead, the book seems more rooted in a couple of foundational ideas, right, and in our lived experience of faith. So I'm curious about the title of Theology of Fiction instead of something like, I don't know, A Christian Experience of Fiction or something like this. What's in that title?
I think I was just bold in generating a slightly inaccurate title for the First Things article, and no one's ever pushed back on that. So, but you make a really good point, because that was actually what the friend who saw the earlier worse version of this book, Will Gosch at the University of Oxford, said. He thought it was too grand, because he's like, you're not John Milbank. Like, this is not systematic theology. This is really a specifically American story, a specifically Midwestern story, a specifically Catholic story. That's sort of restoring a forgotten corner of literary history. But by then it was too late. The ship had sailed. Wiseblood wanted that as the title for its monograph series. But no, you've caught me. I'm a complete faker. I've never taken a single class on theology. But now I love it. That's what I'm reading in my spare time, more than fiction, these days. But it wasn't. It was because I didn't even know that like pneumatology was the word for the study of the Holy Spirit. I just knew that my selfish reading habits from my sophomore year of college on. I didn't want to be an English professor. I didn't want to teach the young. I wanted to wear blue jeans for 5 years and read books because it's so fun to read novels. That's all I wanted. And then somehow along the way, like my faith deepened too. But God can take even our selfish impulses and use them to lead us closer to Him, I think.
Very
So that's
true.
why it's like I didn't actually know anything about theology, but I'm trying to make up so that I'm more qualified going forward.
Yeah, well, you and me both, right? And I love that about God can take our selfish or just limited or very all human, all too human sort of traits and do something sort of grander with them, for sure. I find the book, I don't think it's mistitled even. Theology comes in, as you know now as a reader, in many forms, right? So it works for me, the title does. And I find it's an elegant and thoughtful and really faith-filled, really, I'd say, Cassandra, an inspiring book. And there are
Thank
many
you.
passages in it that I'd love to discuss with you. Some of these passages address facets of Sister Mariella's life and work, and others range, more broadly across the intersection of literature and theology and so on. If I may, can I read a few passages and ask you to
Sure,
comment on
yeah.
them? So here's one. You say that the understanding of fiction you present, quoting you here, is at heart a sacramental, incarnational one. It is rooted in the Catholic belief that creation and its creatures emanate from God, and that therefore they can speak to us of God if only we know how to listen and how to look. Okay, so here's my question about that passage. Do you consider yourself someone who has cultivated these sensibilities to listen and look? I mean, would you see yourself in that kind of way? And do these capacities to listen and look transfer easily between fiction and real life? Or do fiction and everyday experience seem to register different parts of the brain almost, right? I'm wondering how, in your view, learning to read for God's sacramental presence in the world expands into a capacity to see that presence in the world and vice versa.
I think it does, and it's almost like a chicken and an egg kind of a thing, or like, which came first, the tree or the acorn? Because I'm like, I don't even know which came first in my life, but I think that What I love about the indeterminacy of fiction, the layers of meaning that a particular phrase or word or image can have in a text, is also what I love about faith. And I'm sort of a recent, Catholic convert in early middle age, and I'm like, every day it's like a new saint. Like, who's the saint of the day? And like we're in March, which is the month of Saint Joseph. Like, every month has a meaning. I know Wednesdays are Saint Joseph and Saturdays are Mary, but like, I'm like, I don't know what the other 5 days are, and I'm so excited to like learn that there's I guess the point is, like, there's it gives you this picture of a world in which there could be layers of meaning and layer, like, just depths, unseen depths that either God the Creator or, your predecessors in faith had created or constructed or uncovered. I'm not even sure. Like, God is in charge, because it's like, I don't know who made, Saturday Mary's Day or whatever. I don't know where that entered the tradition, but I'm not even sure. It's that thing that, like, maybe it's God again, right? Like, searching for us. That's that thing inside us that's like, what else is there that makes you want to dig deeper? And so I do think that there is a kind of childlike wonder to that too. Like, Joshua Wren, at the end of Contemplative Realism, he has this image of fiction, and the fiction writer should try to arrive at something that would match, like, the wisdom and penetrating vision of, a monk or other consecrated religious at the end of a long contemplative life, but then also the wide-eyed wonder and joy of a child. And so I think, again, like, I had no noble impulses in going to graduate school. I just wanted to spend time reading,
Okay. Yeah, I think, but what you said about chicken and
fun stuff.
egg, yeah, chicken and egg, tree and acorn, I think there's a lot of wisdom there. And in my own case, I've talked about this before a little bit, but I was in my own faith tradition. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is my tradition. And I was a missionary for the church, a full-time missionary in France and Switzerland. And the intensity of that experience with people there made me really curious about their stories. And that really kind of threw me post-mission into reading as a way to kind of try to understand the world. So relive experience drew me into reading. But then the more I read and the more I acquired a kind of a sharper eye for the things in my experience I might otherwise miss. And so these two things really kind of fed each other, real
Yes,
life,
exactly.
right?
Where you're like, where did it begin? Like, my
Yeah.
curiosity about the fictional world, or my curiosity about the real world, and but
Yes.
they've grown up together.
They have, yeah. Yes. I love that, and that's great.
I think it also, it's like when you walk down the street in a big city, you're like, those people are, oh, like, we had a talk about Emerson, and we had someone come in from Noah Tolle came in from Calvin University and was speaking about faith and Emerson, and I had all these, like, bottled up angry feelings about Emerson, because he had this line, treat the other men and women as if they were real, perhaps they are. And it was in the essay he wrote after his son died. So I, like, a little bit forgive him that he was not in a great frame of mind, but I sort of hated that solipsism when I encountered it. And that American, I don't know, reduction of other people to abstraction. But I think if you've ever walked down the street in, like, Manhattan, you need to have that, like, tunnel vision, or you'll go insane, because it's just
Right.
too much population density for me personally, temperamentally. And I think what reading novels, and then, I don't know, community or people and new places, like, you're just like, wow, like, where did everybody come from? Like, how did you get here? Like, I got an email from someone who is a she's from Australia, but she's ended up as a cloistered nun in New Jersey. Like, what's the story? I don't know yet, but I'm excited to find out.
There's a novel in there somewhere for you to write, Cassandra.
Maybe,
Right?
no,
There's.
I don't do that.
Okay.
That's not my beat. I
Okay.
don't have a single. Do you write fiction?
Not. I don't write fiction. I write sort of creative nonfiction more as I get older. I was trained
I
as a
think that's
scholar,
the
but I
best
do.
I could
Yeah.
ever do.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, okay. Someone we.
Well, do you
Some.
know what I mean? Like, the
Yeah. But I do
fiction
know what you might
people
do.
in grad school, I said, is it like years? There's like a theater in your mind, and then the
Yeah.
characters walk around
Yeah.
and you write down what they do. And they were like, yeah, kind of. I don't have that. I don't have any fictional narratives or people, you know, because I'm too busy staring at the real world ones, like, wow.
Okay, here's another passage that I thought was, well, there are many in the book that are great. Here's one, though, I think I'd like you to talk about. It's from page 24. You write this. You say, "The end of Catholic fiction is to bring about a re-education of love through a slow and imperfect process of conversion meant to take place often in a book's characters, but perhaps always in its readers." Okay, now that's a beautiful thought. And for readers who have felt something like it, it's a beautiful experience, right, to feel that sense of conversion or mind opening, mind turning, like metanoia in some ways, right, through what we read. I'd be interested to know how that re-education and that slow and imperfect process of conversion, to quote you again, how that's happened for you at different stages of life and in your own journey of faith. I mean, do you experience inspired and grace-filled fiction differently now than you did when you were in high school or college?
I don't know. I mean, I think hopefully I'm a little bit more perceptive. I think it's Mavis Gallant who has a beautiful sentence or a funny sentence somewhere about trying to impart civilization to children is like trying to throw rose petals at a moving target. So I think, you know, I'm like, I don't know anything that I push my eyes across, but I don't know how much sunk in the beginning. Yeah, because I'm like, I would have read O'Connor, Flannery O'Connor in high school. And I think she appeals to that age group, although I think fewer and fewer teachers are putting O'Connor in front of high schoolers from my anecdotal surveys of college students. But I think what appeals to teenagers about O'Connor is that she's always unmasking hypocrisy. And when you're a teenager, you're like, yeah, like let's unmask hypocrisy, right? Like Holden Caulfield is the master of calling out phonies. But I think then later, you know, I was like, I don't know, she's just kind of harsh. Like, is there ever a story where someone doesn't get a concussion? Like, you know, is there any other way that grace might come to us? And so you know, I think it does change what season in life you're in, what you've just been through. You know, I don't know what you had for lunch. Like, I have no idea, like, where you are in your state of life. I think different things stand out. And I think what I love about really good fiction is that it's inexhaustible. You know, like you could go back to it and something new will speak to you.
Yeah, good. I remember years ago, I was at a lecture given by the Yale literary critic Harold Bloom, and he was talking about because when come on, let me back up. When I was a reader in my 20s, right, in college years, I was often struck by the vivid, you know, kind of exposition of lives other than my own, and processing how these writers and characters would sort of have these intense experiences in life. It blew my mind wide open. And these days, it's not quite the same as I read out. It's different things that come to me. This is the Harold Bloom story then. Bloom, in this lecture, as an aside almost, talked about going back to certain poets that he would read as kind of for deep consolation. And he was, you know, saying this as an older man, you know, in his 60s or 70s. And I thought about that. I thought, yeah, okay. So many of the things that once blew my mind open at age 22, these days I would find not so much thoughts I'd never thought, as much as I'd find a deep kind of companionship and friendship to nourish me in sorrow, or in my seeking, in my desire for friends to walk this path with of the life that I've chosen. And so it's hit me in different ways at different stages of my life, I know.
Yeah, and I think it's funny that like I don't think I'll revisit like The Catcher in the Rye because I'm 42 and I might not have, you know, the it might just feel like grow up, Holden Caulfield, in a way that, or yeah, I read, I teach or I write mostly at the Lumen Center in Madison, Wisconsin, and I did like what did they call it? A learning community. It was grown-ups on their lunch hour. It's a non-credit thing. It's just kind of a pleasant way to pass the time, and it was picturing the good through recent American fiction. And we read Saul Bellow's novella Seize the Day, and it's funny because the character is kind of unlikable, but there were ways in which the book is very much about growing up, it's about fathers and fatherhood, and the character spends the whole book kind of looking for something, but it's like he didn't have the father, so he like doesn't know what the father's love is supposed to look like, and he doesn't know, and he's trusting the wrong people. And there was a way in which I was like, you guys are heartless. How do you have no sympathy for this ne'er-do-well on the worst day of his life? And then by the end of it, at the end of our second discussion, I was like, oh my gosh, like I never grew up, because they're right. There are parts of this person that are absolutely, his own faults. And so I think it's funny to me that, yeah, I'm like, I'm not in grad school anymore. Like, I think he really could have made an effort to get a different job or whatever, swallow his pride. And there are books that grow with you. And I also love that there's a character in that book called Tamkin, who I've read it at least 4 times, and I still don't know what to make of Tamkin. Like, he's a con man, but he also has these moments of wisdom. Maybe he's a fool, like in King Lear, right? Like, sometimes it's madness and sometimes it's truth. But I like those like iridescent parts of a book where you're like, I still don't know. I could keep looking. Or conversely, I've gone back to that well 10 times and something different comes out every time.
Yeah, sure, good.
But then other books I'm like, I think I'm too old for that now.
Okay,
Or maybe there's
all
some I'm
right.
not old enough for yet. I don't know. We'll see.
Okay, too old, too young. I do find
Yeah.
in your book places where there's a kind of a wisdom that sounds like it could have been written by a version of you 30 years hence, right? A real, which is good, right? In other words, a wisdom kind of beyond your own. And here's a passage I really loved, and I want you to comment on this passage. Quoting you here, fiction requires the element of time. Narratives have a beginning, middle, and end. A joke wends its way toward a punchline. Both can offer implicit lessons in causation, quick thinking, and the value of memory. Unlike the news or most of what we read on screens today, stories and jokes both tacitly promise that it will be worth our while to remember, to keep track of something from start to finish, and that we will be rewarded in the end for our attention. I mean, it's a beautiful thought, Cassandra. That sounds like someone who might have been writing about that, thinking about the relationship between reading narratives and reflecting on life at an advanced stage of life. And though you aren't at an advanced stage yet, that's the wisdom there of somebody who has that kind of perspective. Can you comment on that idea about the relationship between sort of narrative and jokes and memory?
I don't even know, 'cause yeah, it's like, where did that come from? There are a few things in here that I don't know where they came from. I did write an essay at some earlier point about kind of, why should we prop up the liberal arts when everybody's, decided that they serve no economic purpose or whatever. The crisis in the humanities conversation that happens over and over. And that's where I thought about the idea of like causation you could live 50 years and not learn a lesson. But if you read a novel, like you might learn something from that person's life in a much more condensed way. So that one I'd consciously thought about. But the rest of it, I don't know. This is where I'm yes, so inspiration maybe, like and I'm trying to play catch up now, because I don't understand the relationship of time and eternity. I would like to learn more about the formal theology of that, but I had this sense of the scary thing about human life here below is we don't know the future. Although I also think that's a great blessing. But that we are like, yeah, that time is somehow a gift. Time is for human beings. Time is where salvation history plays out. And time is also necessary for novels. And how those two things connect and relate is still a mystery to me. But that's why I'm like, what's even in this book? I'm keep thinking about new stuff. Yeah.
I think that's I love that. What I love about it, so if you think about like the manifestation of God in one's life, it can take different forms. One can be like something happens and you say, "Wow, that was beautiful or amazing," or "I had an epiphany," or some awareness, and it's like God's there in the moment. But then there are other times, when the impressions I think if we have of things that are sacred are layered, and they really only reveal their profundity to us over time. And you look back and you say, it's not that God wasn't present earlier, but I really couldn't recognize the presence of the divine until there was enough accumulated mass of these impressions that I could say, wow, look at where God has been. And that's predicated on a sense of both narrative and memory. You have to be able to sort of tell yourself how you got from one place to another and where God has manifested, you know, himself in the middle of all that and through all that. And that's a narrative and mnemonic function.
Yeah, that's what I mean, where I'm like, I don't know, like these pieces are connected. But what you said is fascinating and I think completely true, because Vladimir Nabokov says that the only real reading is rereading.
Mm.
That like it's not till we've run the course the first time, you know, followed the story from beginning to middle to end, and then we go back and we start seeing the significance of the foreshadowing or the significance of, you know, that decision was going to come back to haunt her later or whatever. But the first time around, we're just taking it in at face value because that's all we have energy for or mental capacity for. But the second time we start to pick up details. And I think you're right that life is the same way. Like, I don't know if there's a word for it in psychology or, you know, whatever field is in charge of this, for that moment where there's like a little flag in your mind, but you don't know what to make of it. You're just like, something was off about what that person said or what happened. And then later you're like, oh, that was the impending disaster or whatever, you know, like it does happen in real life. These foreshadowings or these half conscious awarenesses that something is up, you know, and it could be that someone's mad at you and it could be that God is like hunting you down mm-hmm. in a good way. Mm-hmm. But I think that's right. And yeah, even like Aristotle and the Poetics, like recognition is kind of one of the things that's supposed to happen according to Aristotle.
Yeah, good, right.
That's right. Like that's when the character.
Yeah, like Platonic anamnesis, you know, this memory.
Wait, what is anamnesis?
It's a recognition or remembrance of things that have some kind of deeper seat in the soul. It's a way of remembering back these things that are essential. That Nabokov quote about there is no only real reading is rereading, is that from his memoir, Speak Memory?
It's from Good Readers and Good Writers.
Oh, okay,
an essay that was in whatever Norton reader was given out like candy by the Norton rep.
I'm gonna go find it. That's great. I mean, that's a principle I'm talking about with my students, actually. Okay.
Yeah.
Here's something else in the book that I loved. Another passage I loved. And it struck me close to home. And in this you talk about a paradox. I'm gonna quote you here. A paradox inherent to the Christian faith. The good news is never welcomed by all. Some messengers are welcomed in for dinner, and others are greeted by a baying mob. The Christian faith endlessly inverts and subverts worldly logic and worldly expectations, makes the first last and the last first. It dines with the disreputable and decries the establishment, brings those in the periphery of society into the center. To take Christian faith seriously and the revealed wisdom on which it's built is to be kept continually on one's guard and on one's toes. And you add, it's terribly easy to resist rather than welcome the strange, wonderful and endlessly unsettling newness of God's grace, Christ's peace, and the Holy Spirit's counsel. Now, I know from our email correspondence and these kinds of conversations that you're someone who seeks divine grace, peace, and counsel, but I'm curious, are there ways even still that you find yourself resistant to the Christian message, to this good news when it breaks into your human experience? And if so, what's your process for acclimating yourself to it sufficiently to welcome it, even amid that all too human resistance?
That is like the most difficult and deeply personal, you know, it's a hard question. Yeah. And I think it is always, you do always want to resist. C.S. Lewis has some quote, you know, like I'm off Twitter. I feel like these kind of things always popped up on Twitter. I'm off Twitter for Lent. But like something about like when we know what God's plan for our lives is, like the question is, it's not going to be bad, but like we want to know like how hard the good is going to be. Like it's like, oh, like how much will we be challenged in our worldly expectations to be ready to receive that message? And I don't know, like at times in my life I have felt like a Flannery O'Connor character, like, you know, that I My skull is so thick and my habits so set that it does kind of take a blow. It does kind of take a tragedy. It does kind of take, somebody. There's like one character that gets hit in the head with a book or whatever, like literally getting hit in the head with something before you sit there dazed for a second and you're ready to listen. But what's the preparation for that? I don't know. Just humility and trust and hold on. And yeah, to whom else can I? That's what I say in hard times, like with Saint Peter, like, to whom else can we go, Lord? Or to whom else can I go, Lord? You have the words of
Words of
eternal
eternal,
life. Where I'm just like, I'm in this thing now, like, go ahead. But the mercy of the Lord burns. I'm pretty sure that that's somewhere in O'Connor. Even the mercy of the Lord burns. Like, it is, yeah.
So
I think
my own,
sometimes insight is lovely and sometimes it's not.
Strategy, I think, for avoiding, my own strategy actually is
For
avoidance.
avoiding
Yeah,
grace or receiving it.
for avoiding it, in the sense that if sometimes grace can be beautiful, sometimes it can be hard, right? I mean, God
It can be
can.
a sunset. It can be,
It can
the
be. It
pattern
can
of
be.
hair on a baby's head or
Yeah,
something, and
it
you're like,
can be.
whoa.
But it can also be, kind of God's pointing out ways in which we're on the wrong course. We're thinking the wrong thing. We're doing the wrong thing. And that can be difficult for us to get back and off those things. And I consider myself somebody who rarely says no when the Spirit taps me on the shoulder. But my strategy is to avoid getting tapped, right? So I may, so distraction, kind of like practices, things that, so I don't so much say no, but I find myself on occasion walking away from things that might be difficult. That's my own. And then I've got to remind myself that the richest things in my life come because I've been open at least to the possibility of difficulty. And
Yeah.
then through God's grace, maybe it's only a sunset, right, that's revealed to me, and nothing that's all that difficult. But it does require losing some control, and that's a difficult experience.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to finish up an essay. I was at the Notre Dame like Catholic Imagination Conference last fall, or Notre Dame Ethics Conference, and they overlapped this year. And people were like, oh, like, have you written about your conversion to the Catholic Church, which was also a reversion because my infant baptism was in the Catholic faith, but I didn't kind of grow up in it. And so I started piecing that together, and I have to say, like, yeah, like it wasn't an intellectual conversion, even though God gave me like every chance to take the easy way, but I wasn't gonna do it. So he just starts when he can't knock on, at least for me, when he couldn't knock on my brain that I wasn't answering, he started knocking on my heart. And that's where it's like, do you wanna do the hard thing? Like it's not glamorous, like it's not fun. And thankfully in small ways I had to say yes. But then he just asks you for more, so watch out.
Ask you maybe one more passage from the book here that I really love, and you write again about the novelist Carolyn or Caroline Gordon. Is you know is it in, Carolyn
I think
Caroline
it's Caroline, but I don't,
Caroline
I'm like
okay
not an
all right
expert. I could refer you to an expert, but
okay
I'm not an
okay
expert on Caroline Gordon.
yeah
Yeah.
I've not read her work, but she's a Catholic convert, and in 1958 she remarked that she said, quote, "There's only one plot, the scheme of redemption. All other plots, if they're any good, are splinters off this basic plot, and there's only one author, the Holy Ghost." And you add yourself that there's something to this idea of the Holy Ghost lurking in every piece of good fiction, whether sacred or profane, because, as you put it, the right words and the right combination are inexhaustible in a way that points to the eternal. Okay, now I think this is a beautiful idea, and it's one that I and many of my colleagues embrace. And it's one that's upheld by the tenets of my faith. And I'm curious how you discern this principle at work, even in the fiction of writers whose artistic vision is anything but outwardly Christian. Like, for example, I know you've worked on fiction by Samuel Beckett, for example. How do you reconcile your Christian vision with work by authors that can seem very different from that, at least on the surface?
I think I'm like, oh, My brain is tired, but let me see if I can take it in two parts. The inexhaustibility part was an observation, I guess, that came to me when I was doing editorial studies. And part of that in, establishing a scholarly edition, and you want to get your copy text right. I don't even remember the terms, it's been so long, but collating editions. So you're looking at two copies of a book and you're doing forwards, 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 like one to the other. And every time spelling is different, every time a comma is different, is a semicolon, you make a little note of it. And I did that for Samuel Beckett's More Pricks Than Kicks, which was his first work, published work of fiction, even though he wrote Dream of Fair to Middling Women before it. That wasn't published till much later. Anyway, and so I there were at least three texts I had to collate. I don't remember now, four. But there were jokes that I laughed at every time, and I thought, how is this still funny? Like this, how is this, or something that would sort of make you moved every time. And then the other stuff, you're like, oh, we have to go through the Smeraldina's B.A. Do again. Like that wasn't even good on the time too. But then, Dante and the Lobster is a beautiful story no matter how many times you read it. And so that was where I figured out that's where I learned the secret of the inexhaustibility of like, wow, this is the most boring way to approach a book. This is the most rote, mechanical, repetitive thing you could do. And it still shines through it. Like it still can bring a tear to your eye or make you laugh. But then what do you do with the writers who are imperfect? I mean, we're all imperfect. Like we're all fallible. I actually think of Beckett as funny because early Beckett is like hilarious. Like I wish that I had time, and maybe I'm making excuses and could make it, but like, oh, to reread Watt again and Malloy and Malone Dies, like those are funny. Murphy,
Oh,
those
yeah.
his early novels are hilarious.
Yeah, they
Like
are.
if you are under the age of 30 and you haven't read it, read it. It's going to give you 1,000, sort of
Yeah.
sarcastic, brilliant phrases to think about life.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think the darkness is like the light is always mixed up with the darkness in this world. And I write, my dissertation was about like, think of that song. One of these things is not like the others. One of these things is not the same. Flannery O'Connor, David Foster Wallace, Thomas Pynchon, and Don DeLillo. Those were
Wow, yeah.
my four writers. And the postmodernists, I don't like all postmodernism. I don't want to play word games for 1,000 pages. Like, no. But the ones who I felt like had a vision worth teasing out, what I like about postmodernism in these writers is it mimics the conditions of 21st century American life. You're not going to get Henry Fielding, being breaking. As a narrator addressing, the gentle reader to walk you through what you're supposed to think, you are going to have to sort of deal with this overload of information. You're going to have to deal with these unreliable characters who come and go, and you don't know where the wisdom is going to come from. And like sometimes, like an advertisement will have a grain of truth, and sometimes a sermon will not. And you have to keep, your active mind like evaluating and weighing as you go, but also always be ready to receive that little snippet of wisdom. Like that's what I love about Pynchon, or that's what I love about
Yeah.
David Foster Wallace. And I think David Foster Wallace had no coherent, sound theological worldview, because he was half the time he was trying to convert to the Catholic Church, and half the time he was trying to become a Buddhist, and he was all over the map. But that incoherence didn't stop him from getting it right sometimes,
Yeah,
both in terms of truth and expression.
well, he's a seeker too, right? And there's a lot of profundity, I think, in a lot of things he says. I've talked before in this podcast about how I love the scene in John chapter 20 where Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene outside the tomb, and she doesn't recognize him at first. And the reader sees who he is before she can recognize who he is. And what's beautiful about that is the divine erupting out of deeply mortal circumstances. And that's a metaphor for me for what I love in so much work that is not overtly religious. But when you find these beautiful moments of either formal magnificence or inspired writing in terms of like the beauty of the metaphor or deep wisdom. There's something divine in that to me, whether or not it is overtly in any way Christian or concerned with anything ultimate. There's a divinity there which I find beautiful precisely because it takes place in the context of deeply mortal human experience that is very much mine and others. I find that to be, there's a promise in there for me of God's existence, even in places where I might least expect it. God manifesting himself in places where I least expect it, which that's what I love about that kind of thing. That's why I was drawn to that in your book, that idea.
Thank you so much for sharing that, because that was a beautiful articulation of what I think is true on so many levels, like articulation and insight, I guess is what I wanted to say there. Because I've said several times recently that I think supposing him to be the gardener is maybe one of my favorite sentence fragments of all time. Like, I just think it's so beautiful. And like you said, it's about God like erupting into our world and how we like grace is so superfluous that we can't even recognize it at first. Mm-hmm. Like the resurrection was such a surprise that, you know, they didn't even know until, and it's the same on the road to Emmaus. Like, you know, and they're like, whoa, we're not our hearts burning within us. Like right. That we get these. Yeah. And there's a Byzantine monk, John Geometris, who calls us rational sheep, like human beings, like we're like rational sheep. And I'm not a farmer, but like, I think sheep are not very bright. And that's one of the sweet, funny things about like Psalm 23 is like, if you actually knew what sheep were like, you would be like, oh, this is not entirely a compliment. But I love that God is so patient with us. Like, yeah, I think we probably all look like toddlers from heaven. Yeah. You know, like we're just, right. Sometimes we're like a little infuriating, but the rest of the time we're like hilarious because we're trying so hard, but we're not always getting it right. But I love God's patience and sweetness with our human limitations.
I love
in that moment.
So here's the last question I have for you today then. And I asked this on behalf of a student who the other day asked me who I thought the most religiously and spiritually inspiring novelists were. And he meant specifically writers who take up religion specifically, right? Have something good to say about religion. And I mentioned a dozen or so novelists who sprang to mind, you know, Dostoevsky here and Marilynne Robinson there and, you know, et cetera. I'd love to know who comes top of mind for you. If my student asked you, hey, Cassandra, who are some of your favorite writers who take up, like fiction writers, who take up religion and spirituality. Who do you have any sort of favorites that sort of leap off the page for you?
I feel sort of inadequate, but I don't. Like when I was thinking who would I recommend, like the two novelists that if I were going to drop everything, again, I would go read one early comedic Beckett novel, and then years ago, I read Ivy Compton Burnett. Have you read any? She's like a
No.
No, maybe she wasn't even a Victorianist. Maybe she was a little later, but she wrote like she was living in Victoria, England. And she writes these domestic novels of family life, but they're really dark. And I do think we're having sort of a crisis of authority in America right now. And, you know, parents and children, like things are breaking down in weird ways with what we teach and or don't teach our children. So but A House in Its Head was like a novel that made me like sit up straight. And I'm like, I want to go back. I want to see what's in there. And I don't know. Was she Christian? Is it about religion? I don't know. But I feel like there's truth in there for our time to be extracted. And then so she was kind of made me sit up straight, like just a little surprising. And I'd like to revisit that. And Charles Portis.
Hmm. Also,
Betty Wall and J.F. Powers have a daughter that, well, they have five children, but their eldest daughter, Catherine Powers, is a talented book reviewer. She won the Nona Balakian Award for book reviewing from the National Book Critics Circle years ago. So Catherine is, you know, she got the literary genes and she loves Charles Portis. And it took me forever to like read True Grit. And then, I've started reading Dog of the South and it's like more jokes like per page than anything I've ever read. And so I'm like, I don't know, like, is that a bad answer as a Christian? But I think that I think the Holy Spirit really will find us where we need to be.
Yeah, good.
Maybe I need a good laugh right now or something, or maybe I need to know more about whatever's in Ivy Compton Burnett that memory is telling me to go back to, and
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
Nabokov will be like, see why you did.
Yeah, good.
But I didn't set out looking to become holy in fiction. I like set out looking to like have a good time and like evade adult responsibilities or something. But then along the way I got saddled with them and kept having a good time. So that's where I'm just like, I don't know what will jump out at people.
Okay.
I do think Seize the Day is a wonderful novella. I do think I've shared some of my favorites with O'Connor, Pynchon,
Yeah, okay.
DeLillo. Yeah, he's
People that
DeLillo's. I wouldn't want to wake up in the morning and be John DeLillo. All of our
No.
present crises,
Right.
he saw like 40 years ago. So
Yeah.
he probably knows how bad it's going to be in 2065 right now.
Yeah, oh gosh.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I don't want that prescience.
No. Some people,
who do you tell your students to read?
Well, the list I made at the top of my head, it was kind of,
yeah.
You know, Dostoevsky, who I think is just
magnificent, yeah.
Right? And Marilyn Robinson, I mentioned her. Toni Morrison, who I think is amazing. James Baldwin, Jan Fosse, the Norwegian Nobel Prize winner who wrote the Septology, that big trilogy of novels.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
I think Christopher Arbeja in some of his best, I loved some of the religious descriptions in, and like spiritual descriptions in What Happened to Sophie Wilder. I was turned on last year to the novel Laris. By, was it Yevgeny, is that how you say it? Vodoloshkin, the Russian writer, beautiful. Shusaku Endo, writer of Silence and Other Things. George Mackay Brown, a Scottish novelist, Orcadian novelist, writes some just beautiful Christian things. Anyway, these are the folks that came to mind for me. But
no,
I'm gathering sort of other people's impressions too, so other people's favorites, so I can sort of pass them along to students and read them for myself.
I am a huge Toni Morrison fan, although my favorite is The Bluest Eye more than Beloved, which seems to be an unusual ranking. But like James Baldwin, I think we should all read The Fire next time once a year.
Yeah, all right.
That is a book
yeah.
that will grow with you, and
okay.
new things will jump out at you every time.
I want to encourage readers, listeners here, to pick up this book, A Theology of Fiction. I think it's got great insights all the way through it, Cassandra. It's a beautiful
Thank you.
Book. Thank you for your time on the podcast today and for taking the time to write this very thoughtful and very faithful and inspired book.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.